Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome, everyone, to the Lift Every Voice Book Club. I'm so delighted to be here again for another featured book. This month is this fabulous book, The God Who Riots, Taking Back the Radical Jesus. And I'm joined by my always wonderful conversation partner, Claudia Love Meyer. And this month we have the joy of welcoming Damon Garcia. And Damon is a progressive Christian mystic, a public theologian, a writer, and a video essayist. He has a whole bunch of wonderful videos on YouTube that you can look up, including a free series on Lectio Divina, which we'll link to because I know many of you will be interested in that. His works inspired by liberation theology, decolonial theory, and anti-capitalist politics, and he helps people unsettle and untangle the influence of Christian teachings developed to justify colonization, which is a pretty good summary of this book, I would say. And we're really looking forward to diving in to it. So welcome, Damon. It's wonderful to have you here with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And thank you for choosing my book to go through.
Yeah, we're delighted. So I wanted to begin. I mentioned to you before we started that I found your course on Lectio Divina, and I just started listening to the beginning of it because I was intrigued, having a love of Lectio Divina, and I think it's a great resource. But I particularly because you talk about what a mystic is, and your definition may have changed over time, but in the course you talk about it as someone who seeks after oneness with God, but also admits all religious language as limited, which I do like that very much. So I just wonder, because this book club in particular is looking at trying to expand our understanding of what is mysticism, particularly in a Christian tradition, particularly when we're looking at, you know, an expanded set of viewpoints outside of the traditional sort of medieval European viewpoints of mysticism, is there anything that you could add to that, or how you would you still describe yourself as, you know, a mystic, and what does that mean for you?
Yeah, that Lectio Divina thing was from over 5 years ago, but I'm still very much influenced by the mystics and consider myself a mystic. And it's, I think, really important to have both those components in our description of mysticism, that this oneness with God, unity with God through contemplation and meditation and through our practices, and at the same time having this mystery around God and acknowledging that all our spiritual language is limited, and that, and leaving that door open for mystery allows us to also be in fruitful conversation with mystics of other faiths, which is one of the things I love about the mystics, and being able to come together and approach our faith as a gift. It's like, here's what it gives me. Here's what I can offer you. And I would lovingly accept the gifts you can offer me. And I love that. And I think sometimes some people maybe is one or the other, like their oneness, they love that, but it's only a specific God. And only you could achieve real oneness with this God through this specific way. And that often is just painting God as very, very small. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And then, and I realized actually after writing this book, as I started talking about it to people, that a major theme throughout the book is this idea that God is so much bigger than what they may have taught us. And I feel like really grateful to be able to put that out there, because I've always been on this journey of exploring the God that is so much bigger than what was initially presented to me. And that's how I got into ministry, and that's how I got into the work I do and writing this book. And so I feel super grateful I get to contribute to that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful answer. And because I've often felt that I have way more in common with people who identify as mystics or contemplatives in other traditions than I do with fundamentalist Christians, you know, in my same tradition. So I love that doorway. Claudia Love, do you want to kick us off with a...
Well, speaking of kicking off, you jump right in with Jesus in the temple, driving out the money changers. And in this introduction, you say, a den of robbers is not where people are robbed. A den of robbers is where robbers hide, expecting to be safe. There's a lot going on in the Christian world right now in the United States, particularly among evangelicals. What are some of the ways today that Christians hide behind religion to avoid confronting injustice?
Yeah, that's what the title of the book, The God Who Riots, is a reference to, of Jesus flipping tables in the temple. And it was interesting. I know I have friends who are also Christians who love that story. And I have friends who are not Christians at all who also love that story. And it's like they like this idea of Jesus calling out the hypocrisy and speaking criticism against the ways that his own religious authorities had compromised with the ways of the Roman government. And so, yeah, Jesus is essentially accusing the religious authorities of his day of using their religion to hide and avoid the injustices going on everywhere, not just in the temple, which is also a repeat of what Jeremiah did. That quote about a den of robbers is directly quoting Jeremiah, which Jesus often does. He very much follows along with that Hebrew prophetic tradition. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of us that find that more relevant than ever, because we all know Christians who use their religion in that way. And I remember I got into evangelical ministry very young, and I felt like I was called to be a pastor in that denomination. I was in a Pentecostal denomination, and I knew that it would be a huge responsibility. So I just kept learning and studying and growing, and to the point where I disagreed a lot with a lot of evangelical theology. But I stayed probably a bit too long, because I thought I could like synthesize things and like change things from the inside. And I remember one of the last straws, I was at this church and had a meeting with the assistant pastors. And I told them, I feel like I don't feel comfortable inviting my peers, my young adult peers, to this church, because it was the year 2017 and a lot was going on. And there was Black Lives Matter protests. There was Trump's travel ban on Muslims. There was women's marches. There was teacher strikes. And these are the things that my friends were beginning to talk about. And we didn't mention any of it at the church I went to. So I said, I feel like we should talk about something here so I could feel comfortable inviting my peers. And then one of them said, I don't think there's as many people thinking about that stuff as you think there are. And I was like, that was like a moment where I was like, okay, there's a total disconnect. Like I can't, that was one of the last straws. Then I left like a couple months later, but it was a major problem, especially too, because I was the young adults minister. It was my job to bring them in. So it was I continue to see this pattern of churches who use their faith to avoid the injustices. Meanwhile, for so many of us, it's unavoidable entirely. And there's this idea of like, we're Christians, so we don't get involved in politics. I know some churches just went all out support for Trump, and to be a Christian is to be a Republican. The church I was a part of more so just didn't talk about any of it. It's just like, we don't get into that. And we talk about holy things here. And so it was, very, very strange. And it more and more felt like we're just pretending here at this church instead of being a part of the actual world and addressing what's actually going on. And then the longer time I spent away from it, the more I saw like, oh, wow, I put up with a lot of weird stuff by staying for so long. But I know more and more I'm seeing people my age, people older, people a lot younger who are a part of these churches and seeing what's going on, like with all the stuff that happened with COVID and the way churches responded to that and the way that, all the different responses and realizing this is weird. I thought me and my church were like aligned in our values, but realizing they're not. And so, yeah, there's a lot of different things yet again that are getting people to question why their church is avoiding things.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues is the term pro-life. Sister Joan Chittister said it's really pro-birth that a lot of these Christians believe in, because pro-life is so much bigger than pro-birth. It's protecting all of the vulnerable people. And that's that's people who can't afford insulin. You know, that's people who are in the prison system, which you write so beautifully and powerfully about. Pro-life is so many things. And a friend of mine was trying to decide who to vote. And there was this like big list of policies between 45 and Joe Biden. I can't bring myself to say his name most of the time. And this is big list of things that are pro-life and things that are not. And 45 had one thing. It was abortion. It was one thing.
Yeah.
And I can understand the conflict. That's a big issue. But I'll say it again, pro-life is a lot bigger mm-hmm. than pro-birth. Thank you, Damon.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah. I want to touch on your description of salvation, because I think it's sort of foundational to a lot of what comes later. And you talk about how liberation theology is so key to your formation of your own theological understanding. And it was for me too, when I was in college. It was like this, and you know, door that opened into this whole wide world that I had no idea was there. And you talk about salvation as the collective fate of a nation. Salvation is about an actual experience of physical liberation during this lifetime. And I had a teacher in seminary years ago who said salvation is not an individual sport, it's a team sport, and there's only one team. And I loved that, because I thought, I'm not a big sports metaphor person, but that worked for me, because I thought I think people would get that. So can you unpack that a little bit more? Because there's so much talk, particularly in conservative circles, around salvation being an individual personal matter, about like the post, the, you know, after we die, as opposed to the here and now and the collective. So I'd love to hear you speak more about that.
Yeah, the first chapter of the book is called Saved From What? And it's I called it that because I remember being a very little kid, a part of a church, and I was at kids' church one night, and I saw this kid from my school at the kids' church service, and they asked who wants to accept Jesus into their heart or something like that, and my friend that guy raised his hand, and I was like super shocked because he was mean to me and my friends at school, and so at my childish point of view, I was thinking, The nice kids are probably Christian and the mean kids definitely not. And so seeing him raise his hand, I was shocked, but then I was happy because I thought, oh, now he's going to be a nice kid. Now he's going to be nice to me and my friends. So the next day in PE class, Daniel and our numbers on the blacktop, I told my friends, hey, Richard got saved last night. And then they're just confused. And they're like, saved from what? And I was stumped immediately. I had no idea what to say. I thought everybody knew what that meant. And looking back, I realized like I had a unique view of it because of how I started going to church as a very little kid. When my parents decided to start going to church, it was because they had come to the conclusion they wanted to radically transform their lives. They were both addicts, and my dad had been in and out of prison, and they had heard from my mom's sister that this is what you do when you want to change your life. And so they found a church that especially focused on deliverance ministry, which is deliverance from things such as addiction and grief and loss, but then also spiritual burdens. And that's what they felt like they needed at the time. And so that was in my head what it meant to be saved, this transformation of your life here and now on this earth. And then now, looking back as an adult, I realize a huge part of their transformation was having a supportive and loving community for the first time that like helped them in their growth the whole time. And so it's that always stuck with me. And then when I started reading about different ways of understanding salvation and then reading the Bible and realizing salvation isn't just a New Testament thing. It goes back through the Hebrew Bible, beginning with the Exodus, crying out to God to save us from slavery in Egypt. And then as they're exiled, taken by Babylon, they're crying out to be saved again. And then in the New Testament, they're still on the same theme of salvation, of this collective liberation from oppressive empires. But the Christians add a personal dimension to it, and they don't make it individual, like each of you are going to get saved on your own, but more so each of you has the opportunity to personally transform so you could join in the work of our collective salvation, of our collective liberation. And so liberation is, I think more that word more so gets at what they were talking about when they talked about being saved. And when you just read through those texts where the word saved or salvation is used and just replace it with liberation, it almost feels like a totally different story than the one where salvation means going somewhere else after you die or something special happening to your soul that is like a cosmic check mark or something. It's like, it's so much more physical and material than that. And so I do believe, yeah, God is doing something as well. There is a divine aspect to it, but I feel like that's more so God's business. I can't be for sure what God is doing with my soul or with all of our souls, but I do know that we're called to participate in this collective liberation. And that's what the work of God is.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think it connects back to what you were saying about being the mystic, like that I'd say that, you know, that connection to that oneness with the divine comes through that collective participation. And then we also have to acknowledge that God is way bigger than anything we can understand. Yeah. Thank you for that, Damon.
Was Richard different? Did he change?
Maybe for a couple of days. Well, like just went right back to it.
Saint Benedict says, always we begin again.
Yes, absolutely. I still have faith in him.
Maybe he's a pastor somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. I haven't seen him in a long time.
You write about the widening in a time in which your beliefs grew beyond what your denomination viewed as what was right teaching. What was that time period like for you? And how did the people around you respond to these emerging radical views that you were beginning to embrace?
Yeah, I talk a lot about my beliefs changing over time and getting this wider perspective. In this book called The God Who Riots, Taking Back the Radical Jesus, I add that personal element because I'm thinking of all of those who are facing similar experiences of evolving beliefs and perspectives. And I wanted to show them, hey, your suspicions that Jesus is way more radical than what they told you, it's are correct. And it's, you're safe and you're on, you have not veered off the path. You're on one long, consistent path. And of course you're evolving more radical views on theologically and politically are are part of the work of God as well, is part of who Jesus is and our relationship with Jesus as well. And so that's why I include that. But it was through, like I said, I knew ministry would be a huge responsibility. So I had to study as much as I could. And then through experiencing through different relationships with people and witnessing the ways that other churches did things as I was being trained for that. And it just slowly got to the point where I was in this denomination, but I didn't agree with everything in the denomination. And then I felt like I didn't fully agree with everything in Pentecostalism, but also was inspired by other types of Christians. And then it got to the point, especially as I was got really into the mystics, who are mostly Catholics throughout church history, and realizing like, wait, I don't feel comfortable just saying I'm a Protestant and it's completely split from the Catholic tradition. It's like, it got to the point where I only felt comfortable calling myself a Christian. And so that was the journey. And I remember I was able to go slip under the radar of a lot of my fellow evangelical ministers, because I made it a point to mostly just talk about the things I do believe instead of the things I don't believe, the things I reject. And I was able to talk about the love of God that loves us all and saves us all. And they're like, yeah, I didn't feel the need to say, and I don't believe in hell, like, or that I don't believe it's filled with anybody. But it's like, it was funny. I remember telling certain fellow ministers that I wasn't an evangelical, and they're just like, oh, okay. It's like, they didn't get the implications of what I was saying. It was interesting, but everybody knew eventually I would leave. Like when I said I'm leaving, they're like, oh yeah, I could see that. And so some of them were like kind of sad. Some of them were like excited for me. Like, I remember one friend telling me, it's good that you're leaving, but I feel called to change things from the inside still. And it's like, okay, maybe I'll see you later, but I got to get out of here.
Is there anything you miss about being Pentecostal?
Yeah, actually, my experience of Pentecostalism very much was a American evangelical conservative version, and I didn't realize until much later that there's all kinds of different versions of Pentecostalism. And then you look at its radical origins and the Azusa Street Revival, it's so much more than the version of Pentecostalism I grew up with. So over the last couple of years, I've kind of like tried to find my way back to it a bit, because it's still very much a part of me. But I do sometimes think about the intimacy in that form of worship and the way that they did their services. Like there would be worship playing and people huddled in prayers, and this freedom to be able to confess and talk about anything you were going through in life that you were struggling with, and people immediately wanting to pray for you and care for you and ask you about it and walk with you through it. And after I left, I started being a part of some mainline churches. Like now I'm part of a Disciples of Christ church, but I never see anything like that. I never see that kind of intimacy in mainline churches, or at least the ones I've been to. And sometimes I do miss that. And there was a season a few years ago where I was really sad about that and felt like I lost this experience that I'm never going to get to have again. But over the last few years, I've been able to grow a more intimate relationship with the friends I have who don't even go to church or don't even know that experience, and realizing like, I can have that by just choosing to get that deep with my friends and, or go that level of loving and care with my friends. And even this was just over the last year, and our worship service is always raising our hands like for entire songs. And I was at my friend's show where he was performing, music, and the way he was performing, it was just so beautiful. And me and my friends organically just raised our hands and kept them there like so organically. It didn't feel like nobody told us to. And it just felt like that's what needed to happen. And that was my first time experiencing an experience outside of worship where it felt like my hands need to be raised. Yeah. So over the last few years, I've started to realize that I can have these experiences all over because God is in whom we live and move and have our being, of course.
I'm from a Pentecostal background, from the Black church, which is a different experience yeah. from, like, you know, I was Church of God in Christ, which kind of was split from Assemblies of God, and very different because I've gone to all kind of Pentecostal churches. Very different experience, but I do miss the, I don't know, something wild and free about it, and very intimate, where you really felt the Holy Spirit present in like a really yeah. big way. I do miss that sometimes. Thank you, Damon.
I wanted to make sure that we got to talk about your ideas around forgiveness, because I found that chapter really provocative in all the best ways, in that you talk about Jesus, you know, heals people and forgives their sin. And I always sort of wondered how I felt about that. But you talk about this as Jesus forgiving them as an act of undoing the psychological guilt and harm perpetrated on them by others, that he's freeing them from always looking inward for the cause of their suffering. And starting to look outward at the culture that has already marginalized them. So it was this powerful transformation of where they're looking at, you know, instead of internalizing the blame, let's look outward at the justice questions. And it seems like, you know, that kind of mentality is still very prevalent. This idea that those who are suffering in any way have somehow brought it on themselves, as opposed to looking at the kind of cultural structures. So I wonder if you could talk to us more about how you understand forgiveness, how you kind of came to this understanding, and what does it offer to us? What does it call us to, I guess, as you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the main questions I was asking when I was writing the book was, why does Jesus forgive the people he chooses to forgive? And I thought it was, I felt a little funny too about these people he heals who were victims of the sin of this community. He was telling them, your sins are forgiven. And growing up, when I would hear those passages preached about, it was usually framed as, it's kind of repeating something the disciples bring up to Jesus, and Jesus like dismisses, where they're saying that man who was blind, is it because he was sinning or because his parents are sinning? And Jesus is basically like, doesn't matter. We're going to go heal him. It's like, that's the important part here. And yet I think some of that still exists among Christians, that idea. And so it was almost framed as like, well, of course he's forgiven them for their sins. And maybe that had something to do with why they needed healing, especially if they had been possessed, like that they must have been really sinful. When it's like, when we read these stories from the angle that Jesus, the way that Jesus viewed forgiveness wasn't to go forgive the people that were guilty of the most harm, but to go forgive those who had the most harm done to them. And so it's and to understand that sin, like we're talking about with salvation, would have been understood as and more communally. It's the sin of the community, the sin of society, and same with forgiveness. It was the forgiveness of the community. And so what we often see in Jesus's time and in our time, the sins of society, the guilt and blame for that always falls down on the poor and the sick and the marginalized. And so Jesus goes to them and says, you're forgiven, which was also in a Jewish sense had an understanding of had a connotation of release, like release from chains. So he goes to those who had the blame fallen on them and saying, you are released. You're released from this guilt and this blame that and I imagine that was a huge part of their healing, being able to be told that it is not your fault. There is the sins of society, of people passing by you every day and overlooking your suffering, and you are released. God is on your side. You are blessed. And and I think that's really powerful. And I think there's something to that, that we need today, the way that we think about those who are most marginalized in our communities and who suffer because of the sins of our society. And yeah, I want to see more of that. Especially, I think an example I bring up in the book is drug addicts, and how, yeah, growing up, it was like drug addicts are some of the most sinful people. And it's like, it's not a sin problem. It shouldn't be a crime problem. It's a health problem. And so being able to, yeah, to have turned that view over the years, not only helps me understand the situation and the solutions we need better, but also helps me understand Jesus better and what he was doing when he was forgiving people and healing people.
Yeah, you talk about forgiveness as a revelation, a divine disclosure of God's perspective on the world, which is really beautiful. And, you know, I think about, just in kind of terms of the context of illness, you know, even in our kind of more secular culture, there's a lot of that, like everything happens for a reason kind of thing. Or if you think the wrong kind of thoughts, you know, that sort of, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Claudia and Love and I both deal with chronic illness in a lot of different ways. And yet, you know, it took me so many years to realize it's actually, you know, the culture is actually the problem. You know what I mean? If we lived in a culture that was more honoring of slowness in the book, you talk about how, it's really about valuing our essence, not our usefulness, which I think is also connects into this in terms of like an ableist kind of mindset, you know, that we're, if we lived in a culture that really valued everybody for who they were and the gifts that they had to offer, as opposed to not fitting into that capitalist productivity scheme mindset. And yet it's so subtle in some ways, because it's just, it's like that, you know, sea that we swim in. Anyway, thank you for that.
I really am touched by what you said about drug addiction. And you said that your parents struggled with drug addiction. Two of my sons, well, I only had two sons, struggled with drug addiction. And just thinking, I can't even imagine Christians doing something like harm reduction. I mean, I can't even picture it because of the way that people with addictions are treated in society, you know, much less in the churches, where we've got this fentanyl death epidemic going on. And this would be an area that would be wide open for ministry. And I'm not seeing Christians, you know, lining up and saying, hey, let me do this merciful work of passing out needles, et cetera. So that's very close to my heart. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I want to ask you about Christian violence. You said it's important that Christians be honest about this history, not so that we may be overcome with sorrow and shame, but that we can understand the healing and reparation that we are called to take part in. A knowledge of historic Christian violence doesn't have to be debilitating. It can be liberating. Here in the States, we've got people, conservatives, wanting to reframe history so that children are not taught that people were enslaved, or children are not taught that Native Americans, there was no genocide of them, no smallpox blankets, et cetera. And this idea of white fragility that, you know, we don't want to make white people feel uncomfortable. And yet people are still feeling the effects
of this Christian violence. And of course, Christian violence continues when we've got rhetoric happening that causes people to go into clubs and shoot people, etc. So could you talk more about Christian violence and how it can be, how the knowledge of it can be liberating?
It's very important to me to acknowledge the history of Christian violence. And I'm kind of making this connection right now, actually, now that I think about it. I think how it started to be important to me, I guess it always was, but it became a main focus when I started a YouTube channel and making videos about liberation theology and leftist politics. And there was a whole group of leftist YouTubers, secular YouTubers, who liked me, and we would collaborate on videos and live streams together, and it was cool. But people from their audience would join my audience and have these fears that this Christian guy, Damon, who apparently has similar political positions, is he just sweeping all of Christian violence under the rug within history and with today, that like there's a lot of LGBTQ people who joined my audience who were actively experiencing Christian violence. And I would talk about, like, oh yeah, of course that's awful. And we have to acknowledge that. But then I realized, like, no, I have to really be intentional about acknowledging it, because it's important. And I realized for some Christians, when we do talk about this, it just feels like, well, do you just hate Christianity, or are you just like trying to bag on the church? It's like, what about the good things? Let's talk about the good streams throughout Christian history and stuff. But it's like, we need to talk about the problem so that we could get to the solutions. And if we could point to the moments in history where oppressive ideologies within Christian theology developed, then we can envision their end. It's like, we could see what was colonized could be decolonized, what was institutionalized can be abolished, but we have to be honest about what was done. And sometimes some Christians just want to say, well, those weren't real Christians or fake Christians. And I prefer the way that Frederick Douglass framed it in his autobiography, in the appendix, where he's talking about clarifying the Christianity he's criticizing is the Christianity of this land, which is slaveholder religion, but the Christianity he's about is the Christianity of Christ. And so the Christianity of this land, the oppressive, colonizing, supremacist faith that it is real as we can imagine. And to say, like, oh, those aren't really Christians, is, I think, another way we dismiss the suffering that we've gone through throughout history and then also today. And so I even at this point very much understand those who need to walk away from Christianity entirely. And growing up, that was something like, we should never say, we should never be okay with someone walking away from Jesus. Or Christianity or the church. But when we are experiencing a Christianity that has the power and the wealth and the influence, that is using their institutions to oppress people, especially I feel for LGBTQ people who choose to walk away entirely from Christianity, it's like, well, right now, this is what Christianity is. This is the powerful, influential Christianity that we're experiencing right now. And as things change, then that can open up space for people who were formerly oppressed by Christianity to find a new way, perhaps. But yeah, as of right now, it's totally understandable. And but I also know God has plenty of ways of finding people out beyond religion and labels and churches and particular divisions of faith. And so, yeah, it's really, really important. And also, as I'm Mexican, a Mexican American, and I didn't even fully realize, like, the history of my own people is tied to this history of Christian violence and colonization. Like, I remember first getting into progressive Christian teachers and writers and books, and they would address racism and the history of Christian violence, and they would talk about repenting for this history of violence. And I was going along with it at first and like, yeah, we do need to repent. And then eventually I started to realize, like, wait, I was one of the people, and like, these are my people that are being oppressed that you guys are saying we need to repent from. Like, why am I placing myself in this category of white people who need to repent? It's I'm experiencing the wrong that they need to repent for. And so it's, it took me a while to reframe it that way, but that's been very sobering and humbling for me as well, to acknowledge the reason me and my family are Christian is a result of colonization. But at the same time, I'm inspired by so many Christians throughout history who have used their faith to empower their struggle for liberation, to struggle against colonization. And that's the type of faith that I'm about. It's the Christianity of Christ that I'm trying to live out.
Yeah, thank you for that, Damon. And I want to make sure, I want to tie in that the Christian violence, which we might call, for lack of a better term, kind of the negative violence, then to the title of your book, The God Who Riots, and sort of that more positive sense of violence that you unpack really powerfully in terms of, you know, Jesus's act of overturning the tables. You know, talk about the God who riots, you talk about even looting, you refer to a book that kind of unpacks the way that looting has a way of overturning sort of the capitalist cultural sort of systems in a way that can be liberating, which was very eye-opening for me. So I wonder if you can talk more about that story of Jesus overturning the tables as this, you know, act of riot to shut down the temple and get people's attention. Yeah, what, I mean, how do we, I think as a lot of Christians, myself included, that kind of anger and violence feels really uncomfortable. And so yet I'm so compelled by what it is you're exploring here that I want to hear you say more about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Growing up, the story of Jesus and the temple flipping tables was framed almost like a temper tantrum that Jesus has, where he just gets too angry and he can't control himself and he just starts flipping over whatever's in front of him. But if we look at the things he's actually deliberately doing, he is flipping the tables of the money changers and pouring out the coins and letting the animals free, which is putting a temporary hold on the activities of the temple, particularly the outer courts with the Gentiles where that was happening. And he does it so that he could stop everything and get everyone's attention to say this message about how you've turned this place into a den of robbers. And then Matthew even adds this detail of Jesus healing people in that moment too, as sick people start rushing in. And so it's flipping tables is property destruction. Pouring out coins, which is actually a detail John adds, is looting. Because looting isn't exactly stealing. It's just taking the product out of the cycle of consumption. And often we see in looting in modern day protests is done with a spirit of sharing, not a spirit of stealing. That's why we often see products poured out all on the street so that those who have need can take. And what's funny is I think some people could get uncomfortable with that comparison because they may say, well, Jesus wasn't just destroying property and looting just for the sake of doing it. And we forget, neither are protesters. They're not just doing it just for the sake of it, doing it for no reason. It's a tactic of getting attention and being able to call attention to this problem that is going unaddressed again and again and again. And, but then also what I talk about too is realizing that riots are a natural response to this unbroken stream of violence that will, and these kinds of things will continue to happen the more we suppress movements for change. And so in the last two chapters of the book, I go back and forth between the story of Jesus and the temple and giving some more historical context to that and the Black Lives Matter protests, specifically the one after the murder of George Floyd. And I started to do that because when those protests started on the third night in Minneapolis, they set the police precinct on fire. And I was watching this live stream of it and protesters dancing in front of the flames. And at the time, a lot of people were asking, where's God? Because of COVID and unsure of its fatality. And then I remember watching that live stream and thinking, that's where God is. That's where God is to be found. And I, of course, thought of Jesus and the temple. And so I think being able to go back and forth between them can help us understand both better. And so it's I think with violence too, it's important to realize Jesus was definitely not violent, I would say. I mean, in the sense of feeling like he needed to orchestrate violence against other people. But I don't think he was exactly non-violent either or anti-violent either, especially because he had these prophecies about God violently destroying the Roman Empire. And so there was kind of this idea that, of course, the powerful have to come down in order to, for the kingdom of God to emerge. And the only reason I think in his eyes and the eyes of many of his fellow Jews at the time was because the powerful don't willingly give their power away. And so there was this image of God being making things right and taking that power. And so I say that not to encourage violence, but to get people to see these conversations from a much wider lens and understand that there are better ways of talking about this. And one of the ways I suggest to think of it is looking at it through a lens of harm instead of a lens of crime, because that was a big issue with these protests, where people felt like, well, that's breaking the law, so it's immediately wrong, we immediately have to condemn it. But it wasn't harmful, and there's a lot of things that are crimes but aren't harmful, and there's a lot of things that are harmful but aren't considered crimes, specifically police violence. And so being able to reframe it that way and be able to criticize harm when we do see it in protests and from protesters is a much better way of framing it and seeing it from a wider perspective, so that we're not burdened with the lens of crime. And we're able to do it with Jesus. Jesus was breaking the law, and he was crucified as a criminal. But we tell that story as Jesus was crucified as an innocent man, because we're not burdened with respect for Roman law in the first century. And so I'm trying to get people to stretch their imaginations a bit as they think about this stuff.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it sort of ties in, I mean, it ties in to your chapter where you talk about abolition of the police and as an act of abolishing violence, social control. So I appreciate your distinction around harm, because it seems like we're wanting to abolish violence as a form of social control, but sometimes violence as a harm reduction, with the means of harm reduction and a means of liberation, and sometimes is necessary. And so anyway, I appreciate your nuance around that.
I live in Kentucky, and around the same time there were protests here because of the death of Breonna Taylor, who lived in Louisville. And I remember
that there were peaceful protesters and you know, kids being shot with the rubber bullets, you know, peacefully protesting. And then there were times where, you know, the protest did turn violent and stores were broken into and damaged. And the damage done to the stores got so much attention, but not the damage done to the teenagers and the young adults, you know, who were getting shot in the face with rubber bullets. It's a terrible, terrible thing, which brings me to a question that I wanted to ask you about something you said on page 178. You said taking away the ability to oppress from those in oppressive power is difficult because to the oppressor, taking away their power feels like a form of oppression. They won't have the ability to understand how oppressive their role in society is until their ability to oppress is taken away. I'm thinking right now of a congresswoman on the House floor crying because she is urging her fellow congresspeople to vote against gay marriage. And as if this would do so much harm to the world, just simply people who love each other getting married. And, you know, it just seems like there are so many ways that this kind of Christian fascism is playing out right now. But I mean, in a lot of ways, it's kind of been there all along when, you know, when we said this is, yeah, America is a Christian nation. But what that meant was certain people were in power and making the rules when other people were not. And so we have so much work to do. We have so much work to do, you know, for people of color to have rights, which is really shameful after all of these years. We have so much work to do for our LGBTQ plus friends to have the very basic human rights. And it's discouraging sometimes because the people in power don't want to give up this power. I mean, who is it going to hurt for gay people to get married? How is it going to make somebody less Christian? And I don't know, what encouraging words can you give us who want to fight for justice? And I don't know, people don't seem to remember Jesus's relationships to people like sex workers. You know, if he were here today, hanging out with prostitutes, you know, people would be appalled. But, you know, is there support for sex workers in legislation? No. So how do you encourage us to stay the course, to fight the good fight when the power is clearly firmly in place and in some ways it's we're going backward now.
Yeah. Yeah, the part of the book you quoted about how taking away power from oppressors will feel like oppression was directly inspired by Paulo Freire's book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And that was like, yeah, a really helpful way of framing the fact that the oppressed or the oppressors were very familiar with the way that they dehumanize others, but through that process, they also dehumanize themselves to the point where they literally can't understand what they're doing. They can't see the harm they're doing. And I believe that's the kind of thing that Jesus is saying, where he's put on the cross by these Roman soldiers and says, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And so that's why taking away their power in any form, or their influence or their wealth, it is, or redistributing resources, feels like a threat. They can't understand it. But I think it's important to also realize that the way we change things isn't going to get done through intellectually convincing everyone to get on the same page. And what we see is it takes a good amount of people, definitely not everybody, but a good amount of people to work toward change and to have this vision on the horizon for a world where we all are liberated, and to continue working together toward that, so that we, and then once changes are made and are institutionalized, people look around and say, well, I guess this is how it always was supposed to be. But it takes a while and takes work. And I, when I'm talking about abolition in the book too, it's something I find really important, is I like contrast abolition and reform, and reform as in just thinking that the system is mostly okay, just needs some fixes. There's just a few bugs that we need to knock out, and then the system will work as it's supposed to. From an abolitionist perspective, we say that the system is working exactly as it was designed to work, and we need a new system entirely. And so there are abolitionists will work for reforms too, but something that's called non-reformist reforms, where they're the reformist reforms that work toward increasing the power and budget of the prison industrial complex. And there are non-reformist reforms that work toward defunding the prison industrial complex, but also giving wealth and resources and power to communities, directly to communities. I think that's what we have to focus on, is it's because it's not just about taking power, but it's about giving power to the community so that we don't need a state that uses violence for social control. And so these are things like working toward healthcare for all, and housing, and better education and healthy food, and also decriminalizing sex work, decriminalizing drugs. And so it's, as we get there, we get closer to a world where we are no longer oppressed by the prison industrial complex. And so to be able to have this, because it could be scary, the idea of abolition, for a lot of people, because it feels like, well, we can't just get rid of the prisons and police tomorrow. Like, what will happen? But we need to have that as our goal in order to get there and be part of these non-reformist reforms, and finding people in your community who share similar values and a similar vision, and to see what you can do, see the organizations that are already doing this kind of work, specifically mutual aid work, and see how you can contribute to that, and churches to be able to realize how they can contribute to that. And yeah, especially just get to know the organizations in your community. And so, yeah, that's, I feel you though. There's a lot in our world that feels very hopeless. Oh yeah, and another thing I talk about in the book is this kind of pessimism that abolitionists generally have, where we saying things like, oh yeah, the system is working as it should, and it's terrible, and it only leads to death. It sounds very pessimistic. It's like, where's the hope in that? But by being honest with that type of pessimism and that type of cynicism, we're able to have a different kind of hope, which is a hope for a new world with entirely different systems and therefore with entirely different values. And so that's the type of pessimism we see in the prophets as well. It's like, oh yeah, this whole thing's coming down for sure, but there's something else emerging where we're all liberated.
Yeah. Oh, that's so powerful. And I think, that idea of, I heard recently this sort of description of hope as not so much that we want a particular outcome, except that we believe that the action we're doing right now is worth doing, no matter what the outcome, because we, you know, want to build something new. So I want to thank you so much, Damon. It's been really wonderful. This book is very powerful, The God Who Riots, Taking Back the Radical Jesus. It will definitely make you think in lots of really powerful ways. And I love the invitation that you talk about to live out the reign of God as living alternatively to whatever empire we are living in. And I think that that's what you're what you've been sharing about is to live in ways that reduce harm and create communities of care for people who are on the margins. So thank you so much for all of your beautiful work and for joining us. And we're delighted to be able to share it with our community. Thanks, Damon and Claudia, love.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.